Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio program. My name is Keith Pannell, and today I'm going to be talking to a young lady that's making absolute waves in the area of delivery systems, little micro nanoparticular devices that can take cargo, get that word, cargo into cells. That sounds pretty impressive, and it is impressive. And our guest today is Yamuna Krishnan. She's a professor in the chemistry department at the University of Chicago. Yamuna, welcome very much to Science Studio.
Keith, I'm really happy to be here, really excited to talk to you and to the listeners to tell you a little bit about what we do, where I'm from, etc.
Absolutely. And one knows that the name Yamuna, for those who are very, very good at their geography out there, know that that's one of the rivers that joins the Ganges somewhere in Allahabad. That means you're not from America originally.
No, I'm not. So actually, I'm named after my grandmother, my mother's mother, who died when my mother was pregnant with me. So I'm actually named after her, and her name was Yamuna.
Is that a common name? We don't call people after rivers very often in the Western culture.
Actually, in the North, it's very common because it's a river in the North. But in the South, it's a rather uncommon name.
Tell us about the beginning. What was it that made you think that you were going to be good at science, mathematics, biology, chemistry? How did you develop as a young child and get the career that you have?
I think as a child, what my parents instilled in me was a love of reading. My mother bought me books with money that she didn't have. My uncle, whenever he would come to see me, this is my mother's twin, he would come to see his nieces every month or so. And he would carry a Ladybird book, with him. And my greatest joy was to get that Ladybird book and read.
So were you reading in English or was this in Hindi or...
It was all in English, and I was reading books by Enid Blyton and the Hardy Boys, Nancy Drew, Ladybird books. And so I really enjoyed actually reading, and that gave me a very well-developed imagination. So I was a highly imaginative child. So my sister and I, we discovered the joy of experimenting together. We would decide, we would see something written in a textbook and then some experiment in a science textbook. I would come back home and we would both decide, shall we do this? And then we would both...
When your parents were out or
yes,
when they were there?
When the parents were out, always. So anything within the resources of mother's kitchen and father's garden, always fair game.
That's lovely.
And so we would go take kitchen cutlery, go to the garden. What shall we dissect today? How about this dead frog? How about that hibiscus flower?
And then there were lots of creatures out there in your
creatures.
Garden.
Yes,
it's
yes.
A very damp
area. I have dissected
area, right?
Everything.
Yes. But it's interesting, though, that the way you talk about it is it's almost like you grow up in a Western culture. You're reading Enid Blyton, my goodness. I mean, I read that sort of stuff when I was a kid, all right? But it seems to me it's exotically English. And there you are down in Chennai doing that as a young child.
Yes.
Did you read anything in Hindi or were there any children's?
No, I can't. I think I learned, so maybe this is probably my one regret, that I didn't speak my local language. I guess I only know how to scold a child in my mother tongue, probably because that's what I heard.
That's don't what mothers jump. Do, yes, right? They scold their children.
Yes, don't jump, don't bite, behave yourself.
So you can't really then hold a conversation?
Now I can, quite a bit. But when I was younger, what happened was, so me, my sister and my cousins, we were all separated by just a year or two. And all of us started going to school at the same time. And we all started talking to each other in English. We came back home, spoke to our parents in English. They never corrected us. And so everyone smoothly transitioned into English. And then I was once teased in college where they asked me a question in the local language, Tamil. And I answered back in English. And they said, oh, answering in English. Were you born in London?
They're trying to be sarcastic, right?
Then they asked me, okay, what do you talk? What language do you talk to your grandmother in? It just so happened that my grandmother was one of the most educated women at the time. She went to Boston, came back educated. She did her MRCP and FRCS, Royal College of Surgeons. She came back very well qualified, one of very few women doctors at the time. She was even more anglicized than my parents.
And your parents studied abroad also then?
No, they studied here. So my grandmother just went abroad just for a year or two in the early 1900s, I think, no, 1920s, to get trained in a specific aspect of medicine and then came back. And so we used to talk to her in English. So my nickname...
Did that cause a problem with your friends? I mean, in fact, it would restrict very much the number of childhood friends that you would have.
No, actually...
It's like me coming here and speaking Czech, all right? I mean, there's just not many Czechs out there.
So the thing is, we could understand the local language very much, could speak it a little bit with a bit of an accent. I mean, everyone was very good-natured, you know, around. I was very lucky. I was just called Born in London. I was never, you know, that was the only nickname that I had. But, you know, they sort of understood that I wouldn't speak Tamil, but I was not less mischievous.
I read your vita that you actually went to a women's college for your first degree.
Yes.
And that was some plan of your parents, or was that a choice that, and your sister also perhaps? Choices you made or were made for you?
In a sense... It turned out to be a lovely choice made by me. But I can't help thinking that there was some architecturing by my parents as well. I'm very happy with the transition and choices that I made. I wanted to become an architect like my father. But then my math score in a particular crucial exam were not enough. And I missed that seat by 0.25 marks on 250. That's
which I think is about a tenth of a percent or something.
Yes.
If I'm not.
Yes.
Wow.
And then I said, okay, I'll spend about a year studying instead of waiting a year and then writing the exam again. I'll enroll myself in some course. That turned out to be a chemistry course in Women's Christian College. I chose the college because it was my aunt's college. Ah. And it's a really nice, you know, very nice college. Very small, you can call it maybe a small liberal arts college like you would have
here.
And I started studying chemistry and then suddenly I just fell in love with the subject. A year later, my father asked me, do you want to write that exam again? And I said, no, I'm happy doing chemistry.
One architect in the family is enough. And then you started to build things with molecules or atoms to begin with in molecules. So then you went on to study for a PhD and a master's degree in Bangalore.
Yes.
All right.
Yes.
And then after that, you took the needed trip to Europe.
Yes.
And studied.
So when I did my PhD, I did a degree in organic chemistry, and it so happened that people thought that we were doing sort of bio-organic chemistry, not classical organic chemistry. So I went to, in the UK, I again joined the group of very young, very dynamic organic chemist. His name is Shankar Balasubramanian, and it turned out that what is now one of the most powerful technologies for sequencing DNA was actually invented in his lab on the table next to mine.
And this was in Cambridge.
Yes.
Right.
And so I can now, and I know the excitement that I felt at the time when this was being made.
And you weren't involved in it. It was just being right next to you.
It was happening. I was a spectator. I was an observer.
Yes, right.
But I could see what could be possible and how something great actually can start off looking very small.
And also, perhaps sometimes serendipitously. I mean, I had a, not quite the same, but I remember when I started my career in England, in Sussex, and there was a fellow that was doing research in the laboratory next to me and went for lunch. Okay, lunches were important there. You know, we'd go to the local pub, have a drink, have a sandwich, and then come back and carry on. And he was going to do an experiment, A plus B, but he never got to the B part.
Yes.
He said, oh, I'll do that when we come back.
Yeah.
But in the meantime, the A had done a chemical reaction with dinitrogen. And that began the whole area of looking at nitrogen fixation. But purely by accident did he discover this. He wouldn't have done it if he'd had more time.
Yes.
The pub got in the way. It's just a good reason to go to the pub every now and
indeed,
again.
Indeed, indeed. I think pubs are an essential part of ideas.
Okay, so you got a PhD, you went to Cambridge, you studied there doing bio-organic chemistry, and then you came back.
Yes.
And what did you choose to do when you came back?
Yes, so I went to this place, in the chemistry department at Cambridge, I was doing biological chemistry, as they referred, bio-organic chemistry. So I figured to myself that, well, maybe I'm doing biology. So I applied back to this institute in India, applied to a bunch of institutes, And I was targeting to go back to my alma mater, which was the Indian Institute of Science. And I said, let me just go and visit this institute called the National Center for Biological Sciences. Sounds interesting. Seems an interesting bunch of people. I went there and it changed all my plans. I suddenly could not picture myself anywhere else except this place because I found my colleagues were just remarkable people. What they were doing was so exciting that I then said, okay, I'm going to join this group of biologists. And this was one of the few institutes in India that had suddenly started this tenure track position. So, which is again, something which can be risky because if you don't get tenure, then where else will you go? But I didn't see any of that. I didn't see any of the dangers. I was like, this is what I want to do. Jumped in. And after I joined the first two talks, lectures that I went to and sat and listened, I was wondering what on God's green earth have I got myself into? I don't understand anything and I don't know biology.
So, which, of course, actually in science can be a great help.
Yes.
Because if you know too much about the area you think you want to study, you come with so many preconceived ideas. Whereas if you come with a rudimentary general knowledge, you can often make discoveries that the aficionados overlook.
And in fact, that was one of the reasons why this institute that was started by a visionary man, his name is Professor Obaid Siddiqui, who passed away tragically 2 or 3 years ago. He was a fellow of the National Academy of Sciences, a member of the Royal Society, such a wonderful gentleman and a scientist, and it's important to be both. And he was a model of that. He started this institute after he retired because he wanted to have an institute of biology that had minimal bureaucracy, which could keep pace with the movement of science elsewhere in the world. And till today, it retains this thing of trying to keep low bureaucracy. Have only the rules that you really need to have, and, and the rest all just tie you down.
I mean, that's still very important today. I mean, you hear scientists telling you about all the bureaucratic hoops that they've got to go through. And some of it's important. I mean, safety and all the rest. But there are too many, perhaps.
And he's a real visionary because what he did was he created another leader to take over after him. And this is another extraordinary person called Vijay Raghavan, who's now happens to be the secretary of the Department of Biotechnology of all of India now. But Vijay was also this kind of a visionary leader. And so I think the true thing about being a scientist and especially a scientific leader is to make sure that there's someone, that you create someone who is completely competent to take your place when you leave.
That's exactly right. Yeah. You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell. I'm here today with Yamuna Krishnan from the University of Chicago. And we're talking about, well, we're going to be talking when we come back about little machines that take cargo into cells. So stick around. We'll be back. Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Yamuna Krishnan from the University of Chicago. And let's get now to this business of cargo and carrying cargo into cells, and not just any cells, but living cells. What's the principle involved here? And how did you come across doing it?
So, you know, most anything the cell needs comes from outside, whether it's folic acid that needs to be taken inside and turned into DNA, whether it is a virus that is desperately trying to avoid being sent to the lysosome where it will be degraded, or whether it is a toxin that needs to get to the Golgi for its action. You have, if you are a molecule, a dedicated entry pathway into a cell, and that pathway is written in the language of amino acids. And once you know what the language that constitutes that address is, you can stick that same address onto a little DNA device.
It's like a stamp and a zip code at the same time.
Yes, it's a molecular ticket to go somewhere. Right. And so once it's carrying the right molecular ticket, it just has to get onto the right bus that's attached to the membrane and then be transported. It's just that the bus driver doesn't know, cannot distinguish, just sees the ticket. That's it. Come on in. If you're a rhinoceros, come on in.
And so you tried to then make the bus, or did you try to make the ticket?
We made the ticket.
You made the ticket.
Yes. So what we do is basically find out, look for interesting tickets that are very small tickets, you know, very small little peptide sequences, small molecules. And once you know what ticket corresponds to what address, we give that address to a DNA device by just chemically attaching it. And so now your DNA device can sail into whichever compartment it's supposed to go.
How does the DNA little package go through the membrane? Because that seems to me not totally clear to me as an inorganic chemist.
So DNA devices don't punch holes through membranes and get into the cytoplasm. This is not advisable, because whenever you try to rupture a cell membrane, it's basically like scraping your skin. You don't like it. It's not something which will leave you in a normal state. So what I wanted to do was to use these very precise DNA devices that people are making these days, but to try and see if you can use them to interrogate the cell while it is alive, while it's in its natural state, and then understand something about how the cell functions. And you don't want to perturb the cell in any way. And so the philosophy in my lab is to work with biology rather than against it. And so since we know that the cell is anyway going to be taking things inside, like a virus or a hormone, what we do is we attach the molecular ticket to a DNA device. And once this molecular ticket latches onto the bus that's facing the outside, the facing the solution, sticking on the surface of the cell, when enough number of buses are filled with, have got passengers, what happens is that the plasma membrane, this outer membrane, invaginates. It bends inwards and forms a little fat bubble that's called an endosome inside a cell. And this endosome then floats towards its destination. Different proteins come and sit on the plasma membrane of the endosome. Different ones leave. And depending on who comes in and who leaves, this little compartment or this little bus will move to the destination that it is supposed to move to.
Is there a time scale to that?
Yes. It depends on where you want to go. From here, if I want to go to Chicago, it's going to take me 3 hours. From here, if I want to go to Boston, it's going to take me a little longer. From here, if I want to go to India, it's going to take me even longer.
But I mean, the cell membrane is just a sort of a finite size in general, right? So just to get through the membrane.
So it depends on where you need to go. So let's say you need to go to an organelle that's just on the periphery of the cell, very, very much in the periphery of the cell, like an early endosome or a recycling endosome. It takes just 5 minutes. If you have to go to organelle that's situated a little deeper within the cell, like the Golgi, which is closer to the nucleus, maybe you have to wait an hour. Or if you want to go even further than that, like the endoplasmic reticulum, a little longer.
How do you follow? I mean, it's all very well to say this is what you're doing, but how do you know what's happening?
Yes.
And this is to do with fluorescence, I suppose.
Yes. So we use fluorescence imaging to do this. So anytime you use a new DNA device and in any new cell, what you have to do is first establish the time points. You have to establish what time when you add your DNA device, does it take for your DNA device to reach the location that you want? And we do this in two ways. So you can express in the cell proteins that are known to be residents of that organelle of interest. So let's say the organelle of interest is the Golgi. I might use a Golgi resident protein like furin, okay? But I would fuse onto furin a fluorescent protein called green fluorescence protein. So now cells that are expressing furin GFP will have the Golgi glow green. So now if your DNA device glows red, what you can do is ask, when is it after I add my device, do I see red fluorescence coming out of this green fluorescent Golgi? So I should now suddenly start seeing yellow fluorescence, right? Because of the red and the green. And then I know I can stop my clock and I say, okay, I know that
it takes.
Arrived. Yes.
And then what do you do next?
So now that we establish the time points, we can then say, okay, now what do we want to do? Having sent a DNA device into the Golgi, what would you like to do? One of the things that my lab likes to do is to make measures of chemicals inside an organelle.
So it's an analysis system.
Yes, yes. So to measure ions like calcium or acidity like protons and anions like chloride, all of these ions give a compartment a certain reaction condition, okay? I always used to wonder, you know, as a chemist, why is it that the cell has so many organelles? And the reason is because each organelle is carrying out a different function. It's carrying out different chemistry on proteins that are sitting there. And that causes this organelle to have a different reaction, a different ionic environment. Because as chemists, we know that one reaction condition doesn't fit all. We have different solvents. We have different temperatures.
And even they're all in the cell.
Yes.
They've all got this micro environment.
Exactly.
And you can tailor make
exactly
your bus and your
yes.
ticket.
Exactly.
And so you've learned quite a lot.
Yes. And so now, basically, we want to go inside each organelle and make measures of the chemistry inside those organelles. Because here's the interesting thing. When things go wrong in a cell, it's usually because some organelle is not functioning. And if you go inside the organelle, you'll see that the reaction conditions, the ionic microenvironment, is also completely misregulated.
So that leads on to then the concept of therapeutic use of your tickets.
Yes.
And your buses and your cargoes. So let's just talk about that for
yes.
about 3 or 4 minutes.
Yes. So the interesting thing is we're now launching 2 companies based on this. For diagnostics, because I think that we can have what I call the blood test of the future. Let's say you go to any organelle and you make measures of the chemical fingerprint for, say, proton, calcium, chloride, for each organelle, which is healthy. You can now get a measure of healthy and diseased state of an organelle inside anyone's cells using these reagents. So someone asked me once, these are just numbers, right? What do these numbers tell you? But the thing is, historically, we've always used numbers to parameterize healthy and diseased systems. When you go to a doctor, the first thing he does is take your heart rate, your blood pressure, and your number, and your body temperature, and these are numbers.
Yeah, and then he asks you, how much do you drink?
Yes.
All right? And all these numbers, you know, mean something to him and yes. very little to you, perhaps.
Yes. Yes. And so, but the drug that sets you right is also the one that brings back these numbers to the normal level. So you can use this technology not just to say whether you're healthy or diseased, or in fact how healthy or how diseased you are, but also to identify drugs that can work for you.
And change the numbers yes. effectively.
And bring back the numbers to normal
right.
values.
So then, I mean, that leads on to what you
yes.
just alluded to. So,
yeah.
I mean, you're doing more than just basic science now. Your dream, effectively, is to say, look, we've discovered this
yes.
capacity
yes.
to enter cells, identify different organelles, look at what the chemistry is, and do corrections.
Yes.
And that leads to medical advances. This
Excellent.
Leads to healthier societies.
Yes.
And this is now your goal.
Yes. And this is the reason why I left India to move. Because initially what started off as just something in terms of curiosity. Can we send these devices to organelles? By golly, we can. Can we measure chemicals? By golly, we can. So anything that we just thought of suddenly worked. And so I realized what I was sitting on was a technology that could be extremely powerful, that needed to reach people as fast as possible. And that needed to happen in an environment where basic science and clinical sciences were enmeshed with each other. And I found that environment in New Chicago. I just have to walk across a corridor and I have medics surrounding me. And they just have to walk a corridor and they'll find basic scientists surrounding them.
I mean, we hear that so much now on Science Studio, interdisciplinary and the capacity to
yes.
turn around and see the person there that you need.
It's basically science without borders. And I felt that when I went to UChicago. I felt this seamless conversation between clinicians, basic scientists, basic biologists. And then I said, you know, this is where the technology can actually reach its maximal potential.
So this the concept of having a medical facility,
yes.
a teaching hospital, and a research laboratory in the same place, is that not so common then in India?
It's unfortunately not, yes. We have very good medical schools.
Yeah, absolutely.
We have very good researchers. We have research institutes. And we have fabulous teaching colleges like the IITs. But somehow, they're all separate. they're all separate institutes. They're far away from each other.
So, I mean, we're coming to the end of the program, Imuna, but, I mean, is one of the things you're thinking about then, you know, 5, 10, 15 years from now, doing what you said that gentleman did that when he went back to India to set up a new sort of institution. I mean, I know that's into the future, but I mean, we all have goals and dreams.
Yes. Yes.
Your dream is now to bring to fulfillment your technology, to bring it to the health for people. A further dream would be to go back and establish that same type of an institution in India, perhaps?
You know, here's what I always feel. I will never say never, because every time I have said I will never do that, that's exactly what I have had to do. So what I can just say is this is definitely something that India needs. If someone can do that, that would be fantastic. Right now, I want to just stay focused on my current goal. And when anything has to happen, it will happen by itself.
There's a spiritual aspect in your career also.
I feel that there's something which I have always operated with one, where I want to do one thing in my mind. And once that's achieved, miraculously, there's another path that appears.
Yamuna Krishnan, it's just been absolutely delightful to have you here on Science Studio. It's been delightful to listen to you give a seminar earlier in the day. And all I can say is that University of Chicago is very lucky to have you there, making your progress, and mankind is happy to have someone like yourself working assiduously to do this sort of science and technology and a different approach to medicine.
I think I am lucky to have the opportunity to do what I wish to do.
Absolutely. Shouldn't everybody be so lucky, right? Yes. Thank you very much, Yamuna. Thank you very much, Dennis Wu, for putting this program together. Thank you out there for listening. Next week, there'll be another Science Studio. Totally different subject, I'm sure. This has been a wonderful program. And again, thank you all out there.
Thank you, Bye-bye. Keith. Thank you, listeners.
Thank you.